CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city. Stream us anytime at www.ciut.fm.
Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92.
All right, that's Mr. Horton singing about Alaska. And we've had the visit, the big visit, by to Alaska by Trump. I guess that's his first time in Alaska, and probably for Putin as well. We need to talk a little bit about that today on the show. We will... I'll just tell you that we're going to be speaking to publisher of Baranka Books, Robin Philpott, about the some developments. The there's been an important election, by-election in Quebec, and Quebec is French Canada. It's the home of, you could say, the founding of Canada. When they made Quebec and Ontario, they made it out of something called the province of Ontario, pardon me, the province of Canada. The province of Canada then became Ontario and Quebec. there is a party that is identified with the sovereigntist cause, the Parti Québécois, founded by René Lévesque, and it is one of the most important political phenomenons, modern Canada, and it is rarely or closely followed in what is called the ROC, the rest of Canada, unless somebody wants, usually it comes up in a negative form of why do they want this or why do they want that, ignoring all history and the fact that the original Canadian group were from, of course, was France, France having lost in a battle with Britain. Britain assumed control, but they, in order to keep Quebec from joining with the colonies to the south, which would be a problem, they guaranteed language, religion, culture, etc. And that's rarely discussed. It's not it's not repeated often enough so that people get it through their minds that it's a separate nationality, separate language, and preservation of the language, preservation of culture is absolutely existentially important to the people of Quebec. At any rate, that point sometimes gets lost or forgotten about, and then there's, thanks to an electoral process, it reveals itself again. And there's, so the PQ has won an important election. We're going to ask Robin Philpott to discuss that, and also just the fact that, once again, the Parti Québécois is on the rise. Back to Alaska, or north to Alaska, there's a kind of, we're in a throes of a hysterical journalism which tries to turn international politics into a sporting event as to who won, what was the deal, what was the final score, and there is no such thing in politics. In fact, it is not a sport. And I think the most important remark to frame the meeting of President Putin and President Trump was from the Russian leader, who said that the problem we, in terms of resolving this, is false expectations and the tendency of everyone to get ahead of themselves and to try to look to winners and losers instead of saying, what is it about? And is it actually resolvable? I think it probably helped to do a little. It's one of the reasons, just for the fun of it, we played Johnny Horton, North to Alaska. He was a high school teacher who found a unique way of teaching children history. He wrote pretty good songs. He had a great one about the War of 1812, but at the moment the title won't come to me. But at any rate, it's important to know that, remember, that in 67, United States purchased Alaska from Russia for $7 million. And being Yankee traders, they pretended that they were really out of pocket and it was too much to pay for all of Alaska. And they whined and moaned that they should have got a better price. And of course, it is an extremely valuable piece of real estate in every possible way, but it's mineral rich, forests, everything you could possibly want. But here's the part that ought to be remembered. Why was the sale made? It was sold by Tsarist Russia to the United States. And the way it's told is, well, the Tsar needed money. No, no, no. The Tsar and Russia did not want Britain on their doorstep. And the naval power of the day was England. And they were hoping to capture the Pacific West of North American continent. And they had their eye on Alaska, and Russia was not a naval power. And so the Tsar gave Britain a hot foot by selling Alaska to the United States. And the United States connived in it, of course, because they wanted the Pacific. And so they got it with $7 million. They were positioned as a Pacific power. And by the way, it created the necessity of their expansion, because they had to be capable. It's one thing to say you own something. It's another thing to be able to keep it. There are such things in politics as hostile takeovers, and they could have lost that. However, back up two or three steps, the Civil War had just ended, and Britain, who had been very powerful on the North American continent, found themselves with a huge army south of the border, where the American army had, not only did they have a large army as a result of the war, but they had had, of course, 4 years of war experience and weapon development, submarines, et cetera, submarines, yes, and the development of a navy. And the important part to remember is Britain supported the Confederacy. I repeat that. They supported the Confederacy. There's a big pretense here. They did not. They did. And they even staged a raid out of Montreal on Vermont, the state of Vermont, a military attack. And when they retreated and escaped from Vermont, the British government protected the Confederates who had set fire to a town in Vermont, killed some citizens. And so there was very bad blood between what had been the Lincoln administration, the one that signed the Emancipation Proclamation, the one that ended slavery, and the war was about slavery. Everybody claims that there are all kinds of sick apologists or whatnot try to rationalize what it was about. But let's put it this way, 4.5 million Americans emerged from the Civil War who hadn't been there before because they were slaves. So the Americans were peeved, let's put it that way, with the British. And Russia said, how about we sell you, why don't we give you Alaska and you become a Pacific power? And the Americans and the Russians agreed. And too bad for the British. That's not the first time this kind of great power maneuvering, and I use this as a backdrop because we're once again witnessing powerful states maneuvering, and little states are running for their lives and being stepped on. I mentioned a while ago, War of 1812. Under Napoleon, the decision was made by the French to sell what is now what they call the Louisiana Purchase. So it's interesting how America has moved westward. People speak of the doctrine manifest destiny. Well, the cheese was being laid out in front of them to make them move to chase the cheese was the Louisiana Purchase made by Jefferson and it was Napoleon, in his case, giving the British a hot foot because he wanted to see that the new American state had territory and reason to fight off the British. The British had wanted the control of the Mississippi. Well, the Louisiana Purchase put the seal on that dream. so they had the Louisiana Purchase, which was Napoleon's idea to make America into at least a middle power at the time. And then you have the Alaska Purchase, which was Russia's decision to make America even bigger power. But in each case, the target was the empire that at that time the sun did not set upon. That was the British Empire, and the French and the Russians, both in their own interests, encouraged American expansion and brought it about. Guess what else happened in 1867? Canada was created. Why? Well, because the British could no longer hold Canada as British. So it got a new brand, and we had a reduction of British military presence because it was unsustainable. Militarily, it wasn't able, they couldn't keep it. But they could keep it through a compromise, and the so-called Dominion of Canada came into being. By the way, Canada is always having its name changed. We go through a lot of name changes. We have Simcoe Day disappears. We have all kinds of things that are. We build statues and make slogans, and then somebody says, "What is that?" And somebody says, "Never mind, we've changed that." So Canada itself is always. All states are in states. Are continually in transition and development. And at the moment, Canada is treading water, trying to figure out how to pretend it's a sovereign country while obeying the great master to the south. So that's a backdrop. And I think it tied in to what is taking place over this debate about Ukraine, how to solve it. One of the ways that Russia became friendly to the U.S. was that they supported Lincoln. I told you a while ago, the British supported the South. Not openly, by the way. No, it was typical British operation where they said they were neutral, but they were neutral friendly. Confederate agents operated out of London. They built ships in Liverpool, sent them to sea to engage in battle with Lincoln's Navy. So, yes, they were doing that. But the Russians, on their part, actually were friendly to Lincoln and to the United States for reasons of their own. On this program, we've explained that in 1863 or 1864, forgive me for my year, but the Russian fleet arrived in July in two ports, San Francisco and New York. While the Civil War was raging, the Russian fleet arrived and was greeted and so word, feted. A band greeted them. They marched down the main avenue of New York. They did the same in San Francisco. They arrived in the same week. They won on the Pacific Coast, covering America's main port on the Pacific, and they arrived in New York on the America's main port and financial center already at that time, of course. And why were they there? And they were there to guarantee there would be no British naval engagement with the Americans, because the British and the French were talking about helping crush, if they could, Abraham Lincoln and the Union. And they had been talking, and openly, actually, about intervening. By the way, they were going to do that for humanitarian reasons, of course. They wanted to, you know, have a ceasefire. but Russia sent its fleet. You know, that was highly appreciated by the Americans. The Americans never fought Russia, but they have fought the British. And I'm just pointing out that there's a historical background. Now, the other aspect of it is, why would the Russians be so friendly? Well, one, they were sympathetic to the American policies. But when there was the Crimean War, and the Crimea, you will know, should know, is the center of what we're debating now between Putin, Zelensky, Trump, and NATO. Crimea is absolutely one of the main pulse points of this battle. And in 1857, 10 years prior to this famous sale, in 1857, when the British and the French were fighting Russia for control of Crimea, it's called the Crimean War, Russia was supported by the United States. The U.S. was on the side of Russia, condemning the British and the French for attacking Crimea. So here we go now, it's 100 and some odd years later. We've been engaged with this subject for a long time. And in terms of understanding, the American political leaders of 1857 had a better take on what was going on in the area of the Black Sea and the goals of the British Empire and the French Empire at that time. The Americans had a better grasp, and they recognized what they said was that the Crimea belonged to Russia. And then we'll get to the Turks sometime down the line, but there had been a struggle there won by Catherine the Great. She's one of those people who earned the title. So that's a historical backdrop to this meeting. America didn't buy Alaska by just a flip of the coin. It was actually Russia's decision to empower the Americans in order to head off the British. And in the same year, the British made a counter move, creating the Dominion of Canada, and gave them a mandate to get to the West Coast as quick as they could to try to semi-secure a piece of real estate, which they still had hegemony over. This is a long, long story. We'll come back to it. I think we're joined by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Yes, I am, Phil. Great to listen to your story about the charge of the Light Brigade, which is now in Washington, and they're trying to do it again.
Yeah. And people should, isn't that wonderful, that great poem of the Empire, in which what is celebrated is a massacre of their own troops because of a stupid officer who got the order wrong. Yeah. And so they turned it the classic thing of flipping it and saying, my goodness, those are great men. They rushed into their jaws of death because of an ignorant officer. And people recite it. I mean, talk about ours is not to wonder why ours is but to do and die, right?
Exactly.
and they say, bless your heart, you little ignorant soldier. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's not the subject, but it is, in a sense, because we learned that song, that poem in high school here in Canada. Goodness. It was, you know, I that's why I heard it, learned it. It was in high school. It was a necessary, compulsory reading. And to know, we had to know it by heart.
Yes, because so, it's part of your imperial heritage, right?
Exactly.
When they were proud of the empire.
Yeah.
You know, they make fun of the Americans thinking they have a mission. The British Empire was completely deluded in that it was bringing to humanity enlightenment, you know, hope.
Exactly.
And even openly and nakedly declared as white values.
Right. White. Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Values. Yes, real values. But anyway, well, and of course, you in Quebec have a little. Quebec has a very unique window on the British Empire.
Right.
And for some reason, has never been enthusiastic about British kings and queens. And the PQ, I want to ask you about this election, but the last time that it went flash on my mind and in the newspapers, the PQ leaders, who were at that time in a pretty significant minority position, said that they, at the opening of the assembly, I guess it's the National Assembly, that they weren't going to participate, or that one of them at least said, I'm not going to swear allegiance to the king or queen. Right. I guess it was still the queen at the time. And that really got a lot of attention, and it seemed to enjoy a lot of support. Could you start there and tell us how the PQ is doing?
Well, I'm glad you started that point, because that is where you could say a new drive for sovereignty, which is having a remarkable renaissance, you know, a rebirth. That's what I could say. We could say that was one of the turning points. What happened? This election this week was a week ago today. Was remarkable in that the PQ won with a 44% of the popular vote, and it was like something like a participation rate of almost 60%, which for a by-election is exceptional. So in other words, it was a well-fought race, and they won hands down, and they hadn't held that for over almost 30 years. They hadn't held that riding, so it was a riding which basically they'd lost.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the...
That's quite a... what explained that turnaround? What did the candidate say?
And so that's where... What happened in the general election in 2023, 2 years ago? I think it was 2022, excuse me, because it's the next year's elections. The new leader of the Parti Québécois, his name is Paul Saint-Pierre Plamondon. Mm-hmm. He won a riding in Montreal called Camille Lorrain, which is a riding of the man, has the name of the man who developed the French language charter known as Bill 101. But that riding bears his name. He won that with a very good margin. And at that time, the Parti Québécois was not winning anything on the island of Montreal. Mm-hmm. So here he won the riding in the east end of Montreal. The first thing he said it before, and he said it during the election, and said it after, I am not going to swear allegiance to the king, the queen. And I think it was actually king when it came. Uh-huh. No, it was 23. Anyway, I've got my dates wrong. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he said he was not going to swear allegiance. And he just stood to it. And he ended up not swearing it and won. That made a change in the National Assembly that now people do not have to swear allegiance to the Queen or the
King.
Could
you explain that? It was literally a breakthrough, is it so that from now forward they won't have to swear?
Exactly.
And who decided that?
Well, the National Assembly ended up deciding it, because he refused to go in and sit. Mm-hmm. And then they I guess there were enough people who were opposed, but people just didn't want to shake things up a bit. And there were, I mean, Quebec has never, they've gotten away, for instance, what do you call now in federal government when the speech at the beginning of a session, it's called the crown or the mm-hmm. throne speech. Speech from the throne. In Quebec, it's called the inaugural speech. There's been all kinds of ways they've tried to eliminate reference to the queen, the king, the sovereign, and so on. Mm-hmm. But they haven't taken that step, which is the fundamental step.
Yes.
That step.
It would be what they call a constitutional crisis, right?
Right. and then there is a big movement here to get rid of the lieutenant governor because it's the same thing. But anyway, that was he earned a lot of respect, and the other parties ended up having to go along with it, and so he won, and he just stood through it. It's one of these things where so many politicians get sort of hooked into accepting compromises, and he didn't compromise on it. It wasn't. He stood up to it, and he made very strong statements. He said, "You know, this was a result of the conquest that we have to say this the conquest in 1759 mm-hmm. That we are forced to pledge allegiance to the sovereign of England, and so that was the turning point. Mm-hmm. And he's leading in polls." And he's been leading in polls for almost 2 years now. And then, in 2023, that's what I got right, they won a riding in a by-election in the heart of Quebec City, which they had, I think, if I'm not mistaken, they had never held PQ. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like they won that riding. Mm-hmm. It was at the time held by the governing party. And they won it quite comfortably with up 45% of the vote. Then there was another by-election in an area just north of Montreal, which the PQ was not winning, and it wasn't winning anymore. It was the governing party, which was trying to find a way to be nationalist, but certainly not touch the Constitution and not talk about sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And so they won that mm-hmm. by-election, hands down. Mm-hmm. And then this one came along here, and they won again. Hands down. In other words, there's a real rebirth and mm-hmm. popularity for the option of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Now, you might put this juxtaposed, this what's going on now here, with all the people who were writing in the Toronto media that the Quebecers are very much pro Canada now. They have just seen the end.
Yes,
the sovereignty. That's a total. Lack of understanding of Quebec and Canada, by the way, because Quebecers will become patriotic Canadians when they're being threatened by the United States. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they're pro Canada as many people.
No, in the interest of themselves as Quebecers, which
exactly
they go back to the original deal with Britain. You give us the language, you give us the local laws. And which would be a continental system, and we will be with you against the Americans.
Right, exactly. It was, and the people were not.
Cut us short, because otherwise we'll make our own deal.
Yeah, and so the people in Canada were chortling to see that here the Quebecers were becoming patriotic. They said, "Oh, maybe this is unity."
They are patriotic, Quebec patriotic.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean so. But there's other signs as well. There was a poll early in the summer that said 56% of youth, and that is between 18 and 30 or so, mm-hmm. are in favor of independence of Quebec. And this weekend there was a large convention of the young PQers. You know, in uh-huh. that age range, here at the convention center, over 300 mm-hmm. young people got together to talk and discuss the future of Quebec. And so there's like, I mean, it, I guess it's hard to identify where this is coming from, but how profound. It just seems to be maintained. The polls show that the PQ is still far ahead. Now, they've been consistent. They, on international questions, they do not get involved easily. They do know that the tradition, and I mean, people do know the tradition in the, of the PQ that came from Lévesque and Parizeau. Mm-hmm. And I see people referring, the leaders referring to that, and so that but we haven't seen them take a lot of international positions. Mm-hmm. They've been relatively good on Palestine. Mm-hmm. It's relative. Mm-hmm. Well, now, I mean, of course, just the refusal to pledge allegiance is an international gesture. Yeah. You know?
Well, let me ask you apropos of that. I noticed that Peter McFarland, author of Family Ties, published by Baraka Books.
By Lorimer.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself. Published by Lorimer. Yes, you have a book by Anne Charney, which Baraka Books, which was... Anne Charney's book, in many ways, was the that's how I got lost. It was the inspiration for Family Ties, because Peter McFarlane knew the story of Anne Charney and put it into the context of the discussion of the family of Chrystia Freeland. I want to explain that to the listeners, that there is a link. But at any rate, Peter McFarlane, who is a wonderful author, he was evaluating the PQ victory, and he was noting the decline of a, let's call it a left party, which, but he attributes their problems to their odd behavior or views of NATO, if I've got that right. If you could clarify that, I'd be interested.
Yeah, I saw that. He's talking about Quebec Solidaire. Mm-hmm. And they are in like I say, the bottom of the barrel. In other words, they've just gone backwards since, you know, they've been going backwards since the last general election. I think that their problem, I think that Peter must have seen the idea of NATO talking circle, as he said, because they have not. They do present themselves as a left-wing party with interest in international issues, but they will not deal with NATO. Mm-hmm. In other words, they will not, haven't tried to take that on. And the PQ hasn't, but it hasn't. There, in the past, in the PQ's tradition, there have been long-standing debates about whether the Quebec should pull out of NATO or not. Mm-hmm. In other words, that is part of it, but it hasn't been recently discussed. Mm-hmm. But the Solidaire people, they only got 1.4% of the votes in this one, and the previous two by-elections, they were just way back. They're not even in the running, so they don't know. They're a bit lost, and I think he must have seen that because. Their links with the what they call in France La France Insoumise, which is with Jean-Luc Mélenchon and
France's so-called socialist candidate Mélenchon, right?
And he does a lot of that, where he will not.
He straddles
everything, and it you know, like
one of the most dangerous things you can do in politics is straddle.
Yeah,
because sooner or later. You won't be able to reach one of the sides, and you will fall a long way.
Yeah, exactly. So. You straddle, and of course, you think you're fooling everybody, but you're not fooling. You're only fooling yourself because he will go. He will attack Russia on the Ukraine thing. He'll take a NATO position, and so I actually think that's probably where Peter got that idea. They pussyfoot all over these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. They've been very good on Palestine. The woman leader is a Palestinian, so we have to give it to them. But they're inconsistent on international politics.
Yeah.
And you could say that the PQ has been careful, but they don't. They rarely come out and make really bad statements. Or, you know, like I think that they'd rather not get themselves into debates.
Yes.
That right away.
Well, you know, since since Levesque, they haven't had someone who can articulate it with confidence. In my view, I mean, he was a proud anti-colonialist. He liked to identify with the struggle of the newly developing states. And that ability to explain the issues, which takes a gift. I mean, and Levesque had a gift for doing that. They're actually on the Canadian scene, and in Quebec, there hasn't been anybody comparable. And probably they're wiser if they don't have the capacity not to venture into territory that they can't handle.
And exactly. I hope to. I like to think that that's their thinking as well. I mean, as we know, Levesque had the experience of the Second World War. Then he was on an international reporter for Radio-Canada, Algeria. So he was he had the personal experience and the and then his own abilities to explain these issues to the population and to take issues. I mean, to deal with things that people don't understand, you know, like I think you quite often cite the Malvinas.
Yes.
You know, the so-called Falklands.
He had a brilliant moment. Quebec, let's tell everybody that when everyone, the U.S. and others supported Margaret Thatcher taking, sinking the ships of Argentina, whatnot, in order to keep what, I can't even remember the English name, but anyway, it's called the Malvinas, but René Levesque called it the Malouine because it had been named by it had been French territory at one time.
And he knew all that. It was the British.
And in Quebec, they used that word, right? They didn't use Thatcher language.
No.
They actually used the Malvinas.
Yeah. And, of course, Levesque with Palestine was head and shoulders of anybody as a North American politician, elected governing politician. He was, a very strong supporter of Palestine and two states before anybody talked about it. And, of course, in the convention of the PQ in 1981, they invited a representative of the PLO to come.
1981.
At the convention. So that tradition is well known in PQ circles and the younger generation.
So you could call it sort of second nature. It's not something that they feel they have to debate all the time. They haven't repudiated that. It's sort of part of the culture, right?
I like to think so. There are people, of course, who would be pro-Israel in that, but they don't. They will not debate that because they know they'll lose. It's part of the culture, of the PQ culture. Those positions.
Yes. Same with their labor movement. They've never. They didn't. They don't have that hand-wringing, nervous approach of the CLC and others in English Canada when they talk about this.
Partly,
by the way, because we want to remember the Anglo Canada is a corporate boss, and. There's more fear here and a sort of attachment to the Anglo rulers of the country than than you would find in Quebec. And Quebec is sort of a natural alienation from the point of view of the master.
Right. One example that we might have that helps, I'm sure, helps the PQ in these elections is. When Amazon closed they had five warehouses in Quebec, and one of them was unionizing. They just closed the five warehouses, put 3,000 people out of work, and the current premier said, "Well, this is a business decision." In other words, of course, the PQ reminded of how of people of how the how Levesque had answered this when you had these kind of closings, politically motivated closings of like the Sun Life building moving out, the Cadbury chocolate factory moving out because of elections and because of Quebec language laws and so on. Mm-hmm. And so, but the current premier just said, well, this is a business decision, and there, whereas everybody wanted to call in a boycott of Amazon. So, in other words, that is part of Quebec's political culture and the PQ in particular.
Something not noticed here at all. I'm really, by the way, I'm really glad you mentioned that there was a large meeting of the PQ youth of a type probably that hasn't been seen for a while. That is, if it shows up at all, it'll be in an op-ed piece buried in the back of the Globe, but it's not going to be, CBC is not going to talk about it. It's not certainly not the Toronto Star. I want to ask you also about the kind of new development with the wonderful book, Eyes Have Seen, by Fred Anderson. It's going to be published in French.
Right. It's a very good news. The title is Eyes Have Seen, From Mississippi to Montreal, by Fred Anderson, a courageous civil rights fighter who fled to Canada in 1966, but had been very involved in the Mississippi Freedom Summer and in Mississippi civil rights movement from 62 on, very close to some of the main leaders, Bob Moses in particular. And so it's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful history book about Mississippi, but also about his arrival here, his avoiding arrest because they were out.
He lived a life of a very productive Canadian under another name because he was, you know, the FBI and others wanted him because he had been a freedom fighter in Mississippi.
Exactly.
And here he was functioning as a freedom fighter in Quebec.
Right.
Exactly. To me, it's a seminal story. Go ahead.
It is very much so. So one of the, a very highly respectable publisher based in Quebec City is going to be publishing it in French probably next year. And so it's just good news.
What will the title be? They haven't decided.
They decide on that. They probably think they haven't told me yet, and so I don't want to. That's a good one.
They'll
find something good.
We'll leave that as a little secret to be revealed on the Taylor Report when we find out.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But they have to be. Quebecers are going to be fascinated because he was wandering in and out in a close association with sovereignists. His lawyer was a great defender of the sovereignists.
Bernard Mergler.
Mergler. And, we interviewed him on this show, and I wish we had spent, I'm going to ask him to appear again sometime, to talk about Mergler. You could tell us, who was Mergler, and how close does that make Fred Anderson to the sovereignist cause in terms of understanding what it was all about?
Well, he does talk about it. He obviously understands it in the book. I mean, he understands it, of course. But the fact that in those days, people who were political people who were in difficulty, whether it had to do with immigration or whether it was because of political activity, AFLQ, there was one lawyer who people would turn to, and it was Bernard Mergler. And he was, for instance, the lawyer who helped negotiate the departure of certain members of the AFLQ to Cuba in November, I'm not mistaken, November or early December 1970, during what's called the October Crisis.
And, so, where Pierre Trudeau agreed that they could be leave Quebec and go to Cuba.
Yeah.
There was a deal. And so you're saying Mergler was in the midst of that.
Mergler was there, the person they trusted. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the thing. He was somebody you could trust. And the way Fred Anderson describes his relationship with Mergler, he had total confidence in it. And Mergler, because he was being, he had visits from the RCMP who wanted to arrest him and send him back to the States.
Yes, and it was Mergler a matter of hours and days. It was, that was a close call.
Yeah, and then, but Mergler gave him the right advice. He did what he had to do. And he succeeded in coming back and living here because then he couldn't, and it was until 11, 12 years after he had arrived that when President Carter gave an amnesty to draft resistors that he could eventually go home and visit the family, you know.
That was a brilliant work of a great Quebec lawyer. It's Bernard.
Bernard Mergler.
And yeah, it's in that book, Eyes of Seeing. People, I have to say, people have to read that book because, by the way, Fred Anderson puts us in the room with Mergler. He gives us the conversation, and he tells why he has the confidence, and also the wonderful people who, of course, helped Fred. You know, had to move him quickly and all those things. And it should be reminded that not everybody had Mergler, and not everybody had the brains and talent of Fred Anderson. Because there were people who were captured by the Americans and put in prison in the U.S.
Yeah, no, it was a close call. And the other thing that's fascinating is his arrival in Montreal and his experience with, because Montreal was a hive of activity for Africans of all from Africa, mm-hmm. from the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and it was a political, you know, say,
like a really political storm center.
We had a storm center, and they had the big Congress where. People like Carmichael, Stokely Carmichael, came up to Montreal, and they ran into Fred, and they said, "What are you doing here, Fred?" And Fred was living under another name. I mean, all this story about Montreal at that period, he tells it very well from an experience of an African-American arriving in Montreal into a very hot political situation. He was there in 69 at the mm-hmm. Sir George event, you know, the events which had been filmed, and so Fred was there, but he had to be very careful. When the War Measures Act were applied, he stayed home. Mm-hmm. He stayed. He didn't go out because the police had full powers; they could do anything. And so, all that is extremely interesting.
All in the book.
History.
Eyes of Seeing. By the way, I hope you win a prize for publishing that book. There ought to be nominations, et cetera, it ought to be read from Hattiesburg to San Francisco to New Orleans. They need to have this book by Fred Anderson, Eyes Have Seen, Baraka Books. Last cultural note, I think you're, as a good friend and publisher of Ishmael Reed, America's True Man of Letters, engaged the battle over the so-called wonderful musical celebrating Alexander Hamilton, who dealt in the slave trade business. Thanks to Ishmael Reed, we know about it. Now they're going to bring Hamilton to Montreal. You must
Hamilton,
be peeved.
Premieres Hamilton, the musical, premieres tomorrow in Montreal at Place des Arts. And listening to the media over the weekend as they were hyping the show, you would think that the people would not have themselves realized that there was a big, hot debate about Hamilton since it first came out on Broadway 10 years ago. And so Ishmael, I've taken an article that he wrote, Ishmael Reed, who really sparked a major debate about Hamilton, who was a slaver.
Yeah, and when we say major debate, the New York Times carried his article, right? The one that really set the argument going.
I think so. But and they, then the New York Times, 5 years later, ran an article recognizing that, yes, he was an enslaver. It took him 5 years to actually admit, the, because they were all so busy applauding the musical, because it was, you know, the way Ishmael put it, says it's been cleaned up like a kind of with an Ajax, a historical Ajax or something.
Well, look what it led to. At the time when that musical hit Broadway, there was a movement to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, replacing Hamilton. I guess he's at 20, right?
It's the 10.
So, yeah. And that got knocked out. And right. Everybody said, oh, President Obama saw Hamilton and he loved it. So we have to keep Hamilton on the $20 bill. And the abolitionist leader, and who fought in the Civil War, by the way, Harriet Tubman, she was blocked. And everybody just, that has been thrown aside. And now we have to have darling Hamilton, who never had a public office. All he ever had was George Washington's imprimatur. He was Washington's boy.
And
he gets to be on the 20 or 10.
So what it is, like this article, which was included in one of our books, the books we published by Ishmael, called Why No Confederate Statues in Mexico. That's the title of the book, but had a great article. And it was about, you know, black actors dressing up as enslavers, and it's not Halloween. That's the title of the book. And of the article, so we put it in French, translated it into French, and it's going to be out tomorrow online to take on this Hamilton business. But, you know, it's the debate. It's almost as if they bring it in and they're trying to pretend there hasn't been a debate.
Yes.
Whereas, in fact, I think you might say that Ishmael Reed and the they have won the debate on Hamilton.
Absolutely.
Even the Schuyler estate, which was the estate that...
There was even acknowledgement from the sides of the producers at a certain point. They began to say, well, we're not claiming he was any longer that he was perfect, or that, you know, it's only a musical. They began to rationalize the who Hamilton was. But, you know, lying about Hamilton is pretty serious, and making him a hero.
Ishmael makes the point that there are so many different attempts to try and whitewash the so-called founding fathers of the United States, to try and make them into heroes, divinities sometimes.
Yes.
And that's how he classed the musical. He says, a brilliant show, but bad history.
Yeah. Yeah. You could say they really shouldn't be able to talk about themselves as anything resembling a democracy till the abolition of slavery. They should start with Lincoln, and everybody on the bills should be post-Lincoln. By the way, Donald Trump's headed the other way. This is not a small debate. Donald Trump is resurrecting the Confederacy, in naming a fort after General Lee, who was the commander of the slave army, owners' armies. Anyway, we need Baraka books and we need Ishmael Reed's essays. I hope everybody will now dig back, because if they're going to keep doing Hamilton, we have to keep reminding them of what one of America's great poets and playwrights, Ishmael Reed, has to say about this. Robin Philpott, Baraka books. We're very, very grateful.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is the Taylor Report. Of all things, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I am Phil Taylor. So the meeting is taking place, they tell us, in Washington. Today, the show goes on. It's going to be Zelensky and company. And you should not, at this point, I'll just remind everybody, please check everyone's position. It is available. I know that we're not supposed to be reading Russian media, Chinese media, Cuban media. We're supposed to just take it from, you know, the main outlets. Baloney. We need to know what is on the table. And so make it a point to try to find out what it is that is at the core of this dispute. And I would say for the Taylor Report, we want to remind everybody that this crisis, the current one, began in 2014 when an election was promised in which the president of the country, leader of the Party of Regions, said he would step down early and call, and there would be an election. And the Minsk Agreement, I think it was called the Minsk, they said there will be all the parties will put themselves to the people, and that will be, and it'll be resolved in that way. Popular vote, one side of the country to the other. In between came what was called the Maidan something, and actually it was a coup, because the election that they promised was never held. Due to physical threats, the president of the country departed, and a gang came in, and they began to order the country as they wished. Well, it's a party of regions. There are language problems in the country, religious problems in the country. It is historically, the name of the country is Borderlands. And therefore, a civil war situation was deliberately created, and power was seized by elements from the west of Ukraine who, with many with strong fascist neo-Nazi connections. That's simply a fact. Poland complains about this periodically, that the current government of Poland says you shouldn't be putting up statues of people who murdered the Poles, let alone everybody else. But here we have Canada's governed by people who actually are compromised themselves, since they have brought into the country many of those who had been hit Nazi collaborators. That group is very powerful in Ukraine, and that is part of the problem. If they don't address that and go back to being a country of regions where language and religion are respected according to the original constitution, which was thrown out the window by Zelensky and company, if they don't correct that, you're going to have, I promise you, a lot more war. Another thing I promise you is that Steve Fruitman of 33-45-78 is going to be coming up shortly. And we have to thank Pedro because he got us through all this, as he always does. And we'll see you next week.